From KMUW Wichita.
From Toronto, Ontario.
And from Armenia, Spain.
This is You're Saying It Wrong. Let's talk words. Let's talk history and the event that changed the course of the English language forever. I'm Fletcher Powell, host and producer at KMUW in Wichita, Kansas, and joining me, as they do each week, language experts and New York Times best-selling authors Kathy Petras and Ross Petras. Well, hello, Kathy Petras. You are there at your home in Armenia. Ross, you are there at your home in Toronto. We are recording today on a day I didn't know existed until a few moments ago when Kathy was talking about it. We are recording on Blue Monday. What? Apparently this is all over the place, and I just admit my ignorance. Blue Monday, I thought, was just a song by New Order, but apparently it's more than that.
Well, actually, Fletcher, it's primarily English. It's a UK travel company, Sky Travel, coined the day.
And then Cardiff, a researcher in Cardiff did.
It was said by a UK travel company, Sky Travel, as the most depressing day of the year.
Yeah, they commissioned him to research
it.
They wanted him to find the most depressing day of the year so they could sell trips out of Cardiff and elsewhere.
Actually, the most interesting thing to me is there was another company, Walls Ice Cream, that commissioned the happiest day of the year. Can you guys guess that day?
I'm going to say June 25th.
Kathy, you're so close.
Actually,
there are actually several happiest days of the year
when
they commissioned it. The 24th of June, the 23rd of June, the 20th of June, the 16th day of June. Basically between June 1, 21, and 24.
Wow, but Kathy, you were right there.
I was really close. I'm impressed with me.
I know. Well, on this depressing day of the year, I don't think it's that depressing, though. So.
Well, all I can tell you is here in Spain, I've gotten so many sales things in my email box going, it's Blue Monday, buy some shoes.
Don't you feel sad? That's right. Well, Blue Monday was a new term to me, and I think something we can do to kick off today's show is talk about some of the new words that have been added to the OED.
It started, the other week we had said Tim from NYC was talking about the word content and how much he hates it.
Sure.
Well, Tim, we're doing this specially for you because the OED, when they announced the new words they're adding this quarter, one of them was content creator. So
they also added chef's kiss.
Okay.
Do you know what a chef's kiss is?
Sure.
Do you know that, Fletcher?
Sure. That's when something has been done magnificently. Yes.
This one was odd. I knew it because, you know, we have a book company, a rare book company, but Texture. Do you know what that is? Texture. T-E-X-T-U-R. I was surprised they added it now.
This is new to me, no.
Same with me, Fletcher.
Well, it's very old to everyone else because it's a typeface used in Cunabula, the earliest printed books.
Whoa.
It has narrow angular letters. But I was surprised, why did it come into play now? I mean, if they were doing Word of the Year in 1480, that's one thing, but whatever.
Did you find out, Ross?
No, I can't figure out why it became big this year. It was certainly big in the 1400s, but... I
can't find any. The other ones were ones that are not quite as old, but I was surprised. Non-player character, NPC, was only now added. That surprised me. I would have thought that would have been added a decade ago. No?
So maybe that's the same thing as the texture one, like a couple hundred years.
Like cheat code. That was another one. I mean,
really,
like cheat code just now. Snark.
Snark was really weird. I thought that's ancient at this point.
Are they just slow to add words? I'm serious.
I guess so.
Yeah, I wonder. There are other dictionaries, of course, that have added all of these words. We've talked about them. I think Chef's Kiss we talked about a number of years ago. Maybe that was with Merriam-Webster. I'm not sure. I wonder if the OED is just slow to add words, or maybe some of these just are slow to move from the US to the UK.
Or maybe they need to get critical mass in terms of like usage over like 6 or 7 years to the point where, you know, it basically becomes like a giant wave and that's enough. Now we're going to put it in. I don't know.
Well, we also had a listener get a hold of us and ask a question.
And that was his subject line. And I was intrigued, as was Ross. Charles in San Francisco, hello there, Charles, said, I just had to get a hold, A-H-O-L-D, in quotes, of you to ask this. I always thought a hold was either a colloquialism or just plain wrong, but apparently I was the one that's wrong. But why is it a hold, one word? Is it a variation on hold or a conflation of a hold, or is it an entirely different word?
That's interesting because Merriam-Webster has basically its take hold of. It's basically a informal to take hold of, to get possession of, to get a hold of, and then the A and the H-O-L mix got connected. And interestingly enough, they had a New Yorker article with it. They had a Norman Mailer quote with it, etc. It's funny, though. I don't know about you two, but I would never use that. I would always put to get a hold of or take hold of. I would never have a hold. Would you
two? I always thought it was wrong.
It is wrong.
To be honest with you.
It is wrong. It's considered informal. It's not formal English. I would never advise putting it into an article or into a resume or whatever.
OED has it all over the joint.
I know, and I think the OED is wrong.
I too am wrong. I use a hold all the time. I need to get a hold of you, right?
And you spell it A-H-O-L-D?
I do, and I always get the little squiggly lines underneath it when I write it, and it makes me mad, because what else am I going to say when I need to get in contact with you? I need to get a hold of you. It's fine. What's wrong with that?
I say a hold.
I say a hold,
and that doesn't look weird to you? I need to get a hold of you? That doesn't look weird to you? That's bizarre.
Actually, Fletcher, you're right. I say the same thing Kat does. I say a space hold, yeah. Which is really just as wrong as a hold.
I think it's wild.
Take hold.
I need to get in touch with you.
Yeah.
Do you guys not say that? Like if you need to
I
get.
I say it all the time.
Yeah.
Fletcher, I need to get a hold of you tomorrow.
Right.
But when I say it in my head, the little
it's
sentence.
It's two words.
The little sentence writes out in that little sort of chyron in my head. And it says, a space hold of you, Fletcher.
So what do you write like in an email to somebody? I'll get a hold of you,
Fletcher,
tomorrow.
I need to get a space hold.
Wow.
Oh, see,
yeah.
I don't
strange.
Think I've ever written it. I don't think I write
really?
It.
Really?
Okay, I just typed it. I would do it as two words. I would not normally write it, but if I had to, I usually say I got to get in touch with you is what I'd say. I don't
really?
Say a hold really that much.
Huh.
I got to get a hold of you. No, I can't do it. It's one word. I don't. No, it looks wrong to me. I do it as two words.
Huh. It does not seem the slightest bit strange to me to write it as one word.
I would not still advise using it in a, in a formal paper.
Oh, I disagree. I think it's fine to use formally.
I don't know. The fact that Merriam-Webster says it's informal would make me be a little bit worried about putting on a resume with someone who's a grammatical stickler saying, oh, that's obviously wrong.
Well, I don't think you'd be putting it on a resume.
That's what I'm saying. If you or like an article or something like that, I wouldn't submit an article with it. With a hold like that, I'd be worried about it. Someone saying this is wrong.
I wouldn't.
Well, the fact that the dictionary says it's incorrect and it's informal, and that I basically think of it as informal, makes me worry that others will too, and then they will use it as I'm being excessively informal. So, but actually, we should continue with this an interesting segue. Let's get a hold of the main topic today. And the main topic actually is change in language. And we're going to be talking about specifically changes that the Normans gave to English when they conquered England in 1066.
Ah, yes.
And here's an interesting question we have for you, Fletcher. Are we going to have a conversation about this or a talk about this?
Oh.
There's a clue there.
I guess now.
Clever.
I guess now we're going to have a conversation, aren't we?
Yes, we are. We're going to take hold of a conversation, or are we going to get a hold of a talk? Let's go.
So language changes happen in different ways. So in 1066, right, the Normans come over. William the Conqueror comes and conquers England. Now, did they just say, here, have some language? I mean, I would assume there are cases where language changes can happen because of a big shock like this.
Yeah. And this one's a really weird one. First of all, the Normans, English is a Germanic language. We all know that. But the Normans, I mean, like, do you know what the Norman, what the origin of the word Norman is, Fletcher?
No, I guess I don't.
It's Norsemen. The Normans were originally Germanic speakers themselves, Nordic speakers. They conquered France first, and this is sort of a weird thing what happened. When they conquered their Normandy, a certain portion of France, the French conquered them. They lost most of their Norman language, their Norman Germanic language, and they got a non-Norman language, a certain dialect of French called Norman French. Then they conquered England, and they introduced French into England. But what happened with them was, in a way, English kind of melded with them. It mm-hmm. was sort of a mixture of French and English.
I must say, for me, a lot of times, my problem always with the Anglo-Saxon spelling, I preferred, in that sense, a lot of times, the Norman, because to my eyes, all the things like Ethelred and Hrothgar, and I can't handle it. I just can't. Athelwolf.
But the weirdest, but when you think about it, the really weird thing is, if he had lost, and it was like it was sort of a lucky break. I mean, they faked, you know, the Normans faked that they were losing, and then they basically got the Brits to, the English to attack them, and then they turned around and then conquered them. And then what's his face got an arrow, I think, in his eye. But if that hadn't happened,
was it?
Yeah, Harold. Yeah.
But if it hadn't happened, we'd be speaking, as we say in Anglo-Saxon.
but if it hadn't happened, we'd be speaking a sort of, you know, Germanic dialect, and Kathy would be saying, I don't understand how these French and Latin people you know, write their words.
And I would have called you Hrothgar.
Yes, exactly. But anyway, what happened was the languages merged, and mm-hmm. they it was interesting because initially there were only not that many Normans, so therefore they basically took the basic words, they were the rulers of English people. And there are two types of words that came in. First of all, Norman was the prestige language. So Norman French was prestige. So we have prestige words, like Kathy just said about conversation versus talk. Conversation is sort of a prestige sounding term. Talk is kind of basic.
So the Norman French, yeah, the kings and the nobility were speaking that. And then
the English were servants.
The great unwashed, if you will,
right,
who were serving them, which is one of the things that's interesting is a lot of the first wave, if you will, of the Norman language invasion were sort of servant related.
Mm-hmm. Food related words and government related words. We rule you mm-hmm. and you're cooking for us. So therefore, like the dishes themselves would be Norman. The ingredients would be English. Government stuff, like we're taxing you. Tax is a quick, short word, but it's not Anglo-Saxon. It's a Norman word.
Wow. Oh, that food thing is fascinating.
Let's do a little quiz.
Let's do a quiz here. Okay, I'm raising cows and oxen,
mm-hmm.
but I give it to my French lord, and how do I serve it to him as?
What is he eating?
He's eating boeuf. He's eating beef.
Right. Right. Next.
A calf. Oh, look, I've just slaughtered a calf.
Oh, I'm sorry. For calves. Yeah.
Okay, Fletcher, what are you going to eat? Not that we approve of it.
Is this veal?
Yes.
Correct.
Right.
I'm raising swine, or in Old English, swine, or pig, pica.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
What do I feed my liege lord?
But I'm going to eat pork.
Right.
Okay, sheep. You're going to have some sheep
well,
for dinner.
I guess usually mutton, right?
Right.
Yeah, see, now mutton to me, it doesn't sound classy to me. Mutton to me sounds worse than sheep.
Would it have been something like mouton?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mouton.
Which sounds
that
a little better. Quite
right.
Yeah. But I would never, if I said I was eating mutton, at least I wouldn't be, if you said I'm eating sheep, I'd be like, ew. I would think of like basically wool.
No,
or
you're
something.
Right, Ross. Okay, because the sound of the word, yeah,
everything,
legit.
Everything you're saying totally answers the question that a lot of people have, which is, why don't we just say we're eating cow? We say we're eating beef when we're eating a cow, right? And here's
right.
the answer.
William the Conqueror.
William the Conqueror.
The dishes that we eat were being eaten by the nobility. And so mm-hmm. they were using one language while the
right.
the things that went into that dish were...
The guys were in the kitchen, yeah.
Yeah, were being made.
Isn't
oh,
that fascinating,
that's amazing.
Actually? It really is.
Great. Well, so did they not have chickens?
This is the problem. This is not perfect.
Yeah.
Here we have hen and chicken become poultry and pullet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
And those... But we had chicken last night. I
right.
ate it.
We eat
I
chicken,
didn't
yeah.
kill it. I ate it.
Yeah.
And this is where English gets really nuanced. It was interesting because there was an article I was reading with this really prominent Danish linguist who knows all these languages. And he said the hardest language for him to learn was English because of these really weird nuances, which we're going to get into. Oh, actually, let's go do two more, Kath. Let's do the other one. Then we'll get into some of the nuances in a minute.
Deer, this is an easy one.
Sure,
deer.
Venison, right?
Yep. And this is another one, dove and pigeon. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have given it away. But I don't eat pigeon that much.
Although, actually, we were just watching the Great British Menu last night, and for the openers, they were doing pigeon.
Yeah, I mean, I think they would use pigeon versus dove. That sounds like you're eating like the, you know, peaceful dove or, you know,
yeah, the
dove
little
peace,
like olive branch. And yeah, like, no, like, I kill exactly. You.
But with these, with chicken, there was a nuance, but the other ones were pretty basic. Mm-hmm. But Norma's also got into ruler-related words, and some have like a nuance here. The old English word describing king would be kingly. What would be the Norman term?
Royal?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, what is there a nuance with those words? We thought there was.
Actually, Ross, now that I'm looking at it, I don't know that there is for
okay,
me.
Okay, let me put it this way. Charles is very kingly.
Uh-huh.
To me means he's acting like a king.
Yes.
Charles is royal to me means...
he's imbued with this sort of exalted...
He is, like, he's been given royal blood, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, but what about, what if we're talking about my cat's tail? He has a very kingly tail, or he has a royal tail. Which,
I would say kingly.
Is there a difference if I say one or the other to you? Not really.
Ross is saying there is. You're saying there is, Ross, aren't you?
With a cat, no. With a king, I think a king, a royal king, acts kingly, and I think there's a difference with that.
So is he a royal king? The reason I brought up the cat is because I'm sort of trying to, I guess, take the words as what they might mean rather than muddying it with actually having a royal there.
Mm-hmm.
Do you need to be royalty to be royal?
That's sort of what I think in my head. I mean, I know it's not technically correct, probably, but I sort of think of it that way.
Whereas you can be kingly without being royal.
If I said Fletcher is kingly, I would think that Fletcher acts like, you know,
okay,
like a king dispensing.
Okay.
Although, could you say Fletcher has a kingly mien? Okay.
Yeah.
Fletcher has a royal mien. You're right. You're right. You're absolutely right, yeah. Ross.
I
agree with you.
I'm kind of coming around to that side too. Yeah. Anything could be kingly, but maybe not everything could be royal.
I mean, it's very nuanced.
It is very. Yeah, it's very hazy. Yeah. Because I would still probably call my cat's tail a royal tail.
And you're right to do so because it's a cat.
It's beautiful.
Oh, one thing we should quickly say, once the Normans came in, they basically opened the floodgates for more French words coming in. This was the first round, mostly the food and the king stuff. Then later, more and more words came in. They intermarried. They went to France for vacations or to rule a couple of little duchies over there. And they fought the French in the Hundred Years' War. Scholars came over and then they brought Latin in. It's really difficult a lot of times to tell which words came when.
I'm going to start, Fletcher, with thinking. This is the old English right now.
Okay.
Thinking or mindful. What do you think would be the Norman equivalent?
Basically pensive.
Very good, Fletcher.
Whoa, I'm impressed. Okay.
I'm going to give you the Norman omnipotent.
All powerful.
Almighty. Very good.
Almighty. Okay.
Very,
you're good at this.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, we're going to do three. We'll go to fraternal.
Brotherly.
Maternal.
Motherly.
Paternal.
Fatherly.
Okay, sisterly, Fletcher, quick.
Oh, gosh. Sorternal. I don't know. What could it be?
We did it, Ross.
We did it.
The word is sororal.
And this is really interesting, because I would never say my brotherly twin. I would say my fraternal twin.
Well, that's because that's the technical term for it, isn't it?
Okay. Then let's talk about like brotherly love. Philadelphia is a city of brotherly love.
Uh-huh.
But I would say fraternal in certain instances. I would not say brotherly in those instances. Don't you agree, Kathy?
I don't, actually. I think I would use them interchangeably. I would never use sororal. But I would.
Are you
use
serious?
Fatherly.
I always say Kathy is so sororal.
I think I kind of interchange them. I think maternal, motherly. Yeah, she's very maternal. She's very motherly. I think
that
I would
you
use
can do.
Them.
I agree with you on that. Yeah.
You know, I want to bring up something that that Kathy has mentioned quite a few times just in our regular conversations, which is that she often tends more toward the Anglo-Saxon words, despite what she said earlier about whether the Norman words sound better. The sort of more brutish Anglo-Saxon words, Kathy tends to
prefer.
I'm kind of along those lines a little bit myself. I mean, maybe it's not quite so strong, but they just seem, you know, they seem simpler.
They seem simpler. And here's a, this is an interesting example right here below. This one really, this does have a different meaning to me. Ask. Okay, what's the Norman?
Demand, I guess, if we're really going.
Inquire okay. Would be more the technical. And this is where you do see, like, I notice when we go to a fancy, like a auction house, like Sotheby's, you inquire.
Yeah.
They inquire as to your, you know, bona fides. They don't ask.
Right.
They inquire. And that's definitely an English, we have a definite dual use there. I mean, there's definitely a different, in our heads, we immediately hear, this is fancy, this is basic. You can still use ask, but inquire definitely has a higher tone to it.
Wow. Okay. So we're also often talking about people using words to sound fancier. And it sounds it sounds like this distinction that the nobility was using the Norman words kind of has continued on even 1,000 years later. I mean,
those are
the words we're still using if we want to sound a little fancier.
Exactly. And again, we talked about that the basic floodgates of French and Latin coming into English, even long after all of the people in England were still speaking, you know, were speaking English again. Because, I mean, they intermarried, they gradually took over in English. We go to Britain and you're not speaking French. But these words kept coming in and they still had that fancy high tone feeling about
that cachet,
and then of course later cachet, exactly.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Or as we would say in Anglo-Saxon, what? What is the cachet? The smell, the way, you know, what?
Exactly. And then we of course had the Latin coming in too, which complicated things.
I just want to say with inquire, this is something that's I've always inquired about. The question was it enquire versus inquire? Is it E-N-Q-U-I-R-E or I-N? I've never, because I thought of the National Enquirer, was it not? Or was it the National Inquirer?
I think that was an E, but I only ever see it written with an I and just in.
In life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Less American versus English, usually, I think.
But no, but the British had with the I when it was formal.
Yeah.
The E was less formal, which is odd to me because, and then in American English, it's always I don't think I ever see enquire.
You're right,
English.
But when I look at the word, I'm just looking at the word right now. I think of enquire as being fancier than inquire.
Me too.
It's so weird. Yeah.
What about an inquiry? An inquiry with an I seems like an official thing, whereas with an E, it just seems like you're asking a question.
You're grilling somebody. Yeah.
Oh, on that level, I'm going to quickly run up a little bit. We have a huge list, Fletcher. We're not going to go through all of them. But this one also gets me with, I was looking at a real estate ad just today. Okay, live... What is live? I would like to live in Beverly Hills.
This one, Ross.
Yeah.
What would I say if I wanted to be Norman?
Yeah.
I guess I could say reside.
Yes.
Yes.
And this is all over. This is a lot of, you know, really fancy real estate agents have reside. This is your new residence. It's not your new house. Let's go backwards a little bit. I'm going to give you a couple of words that are the French basically, in some cases, the French completely took over the English.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically, we don't have there's no nuance. We don't basically like dictionary. Do you know the original word for dictionary?
Word book.
You got it.
Hey, golly!
Yes, you got it.
What do you mean? What do you mean I got it? It can't possibly be word book.
It is.
See, now here we go again. Why I really like the Anglo-Saxon. Yeah. How basic can you get? Yeah,
and that's where you see the advantage of Anglo-Saxon. I think word book is a lot easier as a kid to learn.
Yeah,
it makes a lot of sense.
Like, well, I don't know what that means. Look at it.
Look at the word book.
Well, yeah. Okay, I like this one too. Amorous. is the Old French. What would be the corresponding Old English? Oh, amorous. I love you.
I don't know. Other than like loving, I don't know.
You're close. Lovesome.
Oh, nice.
That's a nice one, I think.
That's nice.
And I don't want to preview our next word, but what is the... I think this is a much better word, too. I like a lot of Anglo-Saxon. What is preview in Anglo-Saxon or in Old English?
Look ahead.
Well, that's close. Forelook. F-O-R-E.
Good.
Yeah. And in that case, what's preference?
Preference? Gosh. Like more. More like...
Let's go backwards. Okay. What is preview? Let's go backwards. What is preview again?
Preview was forelook.
Right. Now let's go to preference.
Something that you choose.
Yeah.
For
choice. Very for good. Choice. You got it.
Okay. We're going to do one more now. What is preface? Now, okay. What is a preface? A preface is the beginning of, say, a book.
Uh-huh. That I say before I talk. So for talk.
For speech. For very speech. Good.
Okay. It is easier. It's
he
just
got
easier.
Those without any hints, Ross.
He's an Anglo-Saxon now.
We have a lot of other words, obviously, here, Fletcher. But the one thing that Ross did most of the research for this, I must admit, and it's fascinating to see, we go back to the nuances or the effects that the Norman influence has in certain terms and the Anglo-Saxon the other. And we had, this is what I really like, Orwell talked about how you don't, that there's the horrible thing that the Saxon has been overtaken. I love Orwell, as does Ross.
Yeah.
But he says bad writers, especially scientific, political, sociological writers, are nearly always haunted by the notion that Latin or Greek words are grander than Saxon ones. Unnecessary words. He keeps going on about how we should, like, what's wrong with Anglo-Saxon, which exactly. is very nice.
Mm-hmm. And then I picked up the 1945 collected essays of George Orwell, and an article I picked up, this phenomenon, which he mentions as a bad word, has elements of, which he also mentions as a bad word, theoretical knowledge of, justification of, et cetera, pronouncements about which I would not, this theory, et cetera, invisible ships passing along horizons with a theoretical knowledge, ordinary, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It was packed, jam-packed with...
Non-Anglo-Saxon. George, you let me down. I also think, I love this, that the other thing, it's called the Latin finish in rhetoric. And it's using Old French, the Norman again, and Latin words to contrast with the Old English, a.k.a. Anglo-Saxon words.
Mm-hmm.
And you see this, and again, I credit Ross, looking at the Bible, for example, tends to use the Old English for good stuff, the Old French for bad. That was the opposite of what you'd expect.
Oh, no, but a lot of times the Old English is an appeal to the gut. The Old French is to the mind. And in that sense, what you do is sometimes it's for the bad, but other times it's also just a gut feel that you get. You get a real kick in the butt, you know, in the gut, and then you basically think about it. That was big. I was actually big on Churchill as well. Wow. He called this the Saxon restatement, which the Bible does as well. And he has one famous saying, you know, with the World War II. I say to the House, as I said to ministers who have joined this government, I have nothing to offer. But blood, toil, tears, and sweat. Blood, toil, tears, and sweat, Anglo-Saxon. Then he switches over to Old French. We have before us an ordeal of the most grievous kind.
Yeah.
It's a lovely tension. You know what I mean? It's a perfect verbal tension there, I think.
You're Saying It Wrong is part of the NPR network and is produced in the studios of KMUW in Wichita, Kansas, by me, Fletcher Powell. Kathy Petras records from her home in Armia, Spain. Ross Petras from his home in Toronto, Ontario, in Canada. Torrin Anderson composed our theme music, and our digital team is Beth Golay, Kate Hutchins, and Carly Cooper. You can find all of our past episodes by subscribing to the You're Saying It Wrong podcast wherever you get your podcasts, or by visiting us at kmuw.org. If you have a question for Kathy and Ross, if you'd like to suggest a topic, or you just want to reach out, you can email me at powell@kmuw.org or email them at kandrpetris@gmail.com. You can also email us a voice memo of you asking it your question. You might get your voice heard on air. If you'd like to do the same thing by downloading the KMUW app, you can do that and just click the Talk to Us button. You can find all of Kathy and Ross's books pretty much anywhere you get books, and a handful of them are also available on audiobook, read by the authors themselves. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.